it's great to know that the efforts of all of these students from different campuses, from, you know, the smallest campuses to the largest campuses, have actually paid off, and that the administration is listening to us.
UA students express relief after Regents vote on tuition. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, the 24th of September. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the condition of a brown bear near Haines surprises biologists.
Just amazing that this animal has been able to continue to survive with the serious need of a trip to the dentist.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by First National Bank Alaska, branches in 18 communities around the state and on the web at fnbalaska.com, member FDIC, equal housing lender. And by GrantStation, your fast track to funding, helping identify appropriate grant makers for your organization's programs and projects, on the web at grantstation.com.
No change to a previously approved tuition hike for University of Alaska students starting next school year. The UA Board of Regents this morning in Juneau voted to hold the line on undergraduate tuition and put on hold until November, a decision to increase it for the following year. KTOO's Casey Kelly has more.
Regents had been considering a 5% tuition increase for 100 and 200 level undergraduate courses starting next fall. That would have been on top of a 5% increase approved in December for all undergraduate classes. The board also was considering a proposal to raise tuition 10 to 12% in the fall of 2012. The decision to keep next year's rate the same was unanimous. For Regent Tim Brady, it came down to honoring a commitment to students.
We already made a deal, and I just don't think it's appropriate to go back and make that change.
The proposal to increase tuition next school year was made by former University of Alaska President Mark Hamilton before he retired. But Hamilton's predecessor, Pat Gamble, agreed with Regents.
I think that's an ethical issue, and unless there are extenuating emergency kinds of circumstances whereupon then it's right to sit down and look and say if the situation has changed materially, then we feel fair in going back to the drawing boards. But in this particular case, I don't think that's warranted, so I agree with the Regents.
Regent Carl Mars said the president should put together a committee of students and school administrators to be involved in decisions on future tuition increases. Gamble said why not start with the proposed increase for 2012, which could be approved at the board's next meeting in November.
We can put that group together and start talking now and see if, in fact, there are other alternatives that, and we've got a number out there that we all know that we can gravitate back to if we need to, but there may be some other ideas. And so I think there's room for that discussion to take place with the students and crunch some numbers at the same time.
As an alternative to the 10 to 12% increase proposed by the administration, the UA Coalition of Student Leaders has suggested a 7% increase in 2 years. Gamble said it wasn't the protests on all three major University of Alaska campuses this week that swayed him, but rather the willingness of those student leaders to compromise.
10 times the number of picket signs would not have moved me at all. Peter's suggestion last Friday about how to go forward in the compromise position that they presented made all the difference in the world in terms of the negotiation that needs to go on a tough subject like this.
The Peter he referred to is Peter Finn, spokesman for the Coalition of Student Leaders.
It's a really great feeling, and it leaves me feeling very optimistic about how things are going to look going forward. It's great to know that the efforts of all of these students from different campuses, from, you know, the smallest campuses to the largest campuses, have actually paid off, and that the administration is listening to us.
The increase proposed for next academic year was estimated to bring in an additional $2.5 million in revenue. University of Alaska Anchorage Chancellor Fran Ulmer says tuition makes up about 25% of UAA's budget. But she won't know how the decision not to increase next fall's rate will affect programs and services until she knows how much funding the school will get from the legislature and the results of ongoing labor talks with university employees.
So we don't know yet what difference it will make. Probably it's about $1 million to us, somewhere in that neighborhood, which is always a problem from the standpoint of balancing a budget. But hopefully we will be able to make the case to the legislature that what we're doing has value and that they will continue to support us in a way that allows us to keep our program strong.
The Board of Regents' next meeting is scheduled for November 9th in Anchorage, where it's supposed to approve the university's fiscal year 2012 operating and capital budgets. In Juneau, I'm Casey Kelly.
Governor Parnell today affirmed his endorsement of Republican and Tea Party candidate Joe Miller's bid for the U.S. Senate seat now occupied by Lisa Murkowski. The two appeared at the same event in Wasilla today. The governor was quoted recently as saying he thinks highly of Senator Murkowski, but his campaign manager, Michelle Tuohy, says today's appearance shows that he also thinks highly of Miller.
He's proud to support the voters' nominee in the August 24th primary. And he said that he stood proudly in support of Joe Miller for U.S. Senate. He said that Joe is a constitutional conservative and that he'll be a principled leader. But it's really about, you know, honoring the primary process and standing up for that candidate who the voters choose in that process.
Earlier this week, Parnell endorsed the Republican Party's nominee without using Miller's name during a candidate debate in Anchorage. But today's joint event was the first time they had personally aligned their campaigns. Tuohy says there might be future joint appearances, but that the governor has his own race to consider. Miller is running against Democrat Scott McAdams as well as running against Senator Murkowski's re-election attempt by looking for write-in votes. Murkowski was traveling in Juneau today. Congressman Don Young is not endorsing a candidate in the U.S. Senate race. He says he called both Republicans, Lisa Murkowski and Joe Miller, to explain why he's staying out of it.
Senator Murkowski has been a friend of mine. Senator Murkowski Sr. is a friend of mine. And Frank and I and Nancy Ben Lou have been friends for 40 years. Served with him when he was commissioner, hunt with him, and break bread with him, and watch their kids grow up as they watch mine. So that's a friendship. Joe won it the race in the primary, and I respect that. But I'm not going to support him, primarily for the reason of Lisa.
Young says he's disappointed that more Alaskans don't turn out for primary contests, so he'd like to move Alaska's primary from August to either springtime or early October, when he says more people would be engaged in politics. Young says while Lisa Murkowski has a long shot as a write-in candidate, it's not time to count her out.
It's always hard. I always say, though, that there's nothing impossible. And you know, it just, we'll see what happens. It all depends on desire and those that people believe it, that they had better participate. If they don't, well, then it won't happen, you know.
Yesterday, U.S. House Republicans unveiled their new goals, what they've named the Pledge to America. It calls for reducing government spending and repealing the Health Care Act signed into law this year. It's a lot like the Contract for America that Republicans launched in 1994. Representative Young says he generally agrees with it.
You know, I'm supporting it. I'm one of the few people that ever signed a Contract for America, too. I'm independent, as I believe Alaskans are. I think what they want to do is right. What they didn't do, and I wish they had have done, I tried to talk them into it, but they said it was too complicated. Our biggest challenge in this country right now is the 1,450,000 regulatory laws that are laws that were never voted on.
Other House Republicans are also supporting their conference's new plan, but conservative critics say it doesn't go far enough and it's too much like the effort Republicans made in the 1990s. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a rich discovery near Skagway that's green, not gold.
I like to think of Alaska as being something of the Amazon of lichen diversity.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
The union trying to organize a group of University of Alaska support personnel is taking a step back. The Alaska State Employees Association has informed the 2,500-member group of employees that it's canceled a union vote scheduled for this fall. ASEA business manager Jim Duncan says organizers aren't giving up, but need more time to inform staff about unionization.
We are still going to be active in organizing the university staff. We still think it's important for them to have a unified voice to work with management on a lot of issues, worksite issues, salary benefits, et cetera. So we still think there's a benefit. We just felt at this time we didn't have the time to respond to some of the misstatements that were being made and the mischaracterizations of what a union can do for individuals, for staff. We didn't think we had time to fully inform staff so that they could have a good, educated, fully informed vote.
Duncan says the university has been putting out a lot of information about unionization, and that's raised a lot of questions among affected staff.
I understand the university wants people to be fully informed, but to try to speak for us as they are doing on their mailings and say what the union is going to do for them or not do for them or what our due structure is going to be and what it means to them and what type of provisions will we negotiating in a contract, et cetera, they shouldn't be doing that. So we want to be sure if members understand, potential members understand our structure, how the union will operate, how they have a voice, and they are the ones who make the determination on what will be negotiated in a collective bargaining agreement, because this is a member-driven organization.
Duncan says the ASEA will hold more meetings and send out mailings. He says it's not unusual for unionization to take a longer time than anticipated, and that ASEA will work to thoroughly answer all questions before rescheduling an election. Duncan says ASEA dues are based on a sliding scale according to salary and are only collected after collective bargaining agreements are hammered out. A chart shows that an employee that makes $50,000 per year would pay $640 in annual dues. Klondike Gold Rush National Historic Park is one of the world's richest areas for lichen diversity. A new inventory of lichen in the park turned up hundreds of different lichen species, and dozens of them have never been identified before. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
Toby Spriebele has been fascinated with lichen since he was a young boy growing up in the Northwoods of Minnesota. Lichen is now the subject of his PhD thesis at the University of Graz in Austria, so his expectations were high when he set out to collect specimens in Klondike Historical Park near Skagway. His first trip into the forest did not disappoint.
We noticed right from the very first hours of fieldwork that this was a very rich area, at least as rich as any other area that any of us had ever worked in before. So it was pretty exciting.
Spriebele spent more than 30 days in the field and collected more than 3,500 lichen samples. Back in the lab, he identified 766 different species. Spriebele says that number is especially impressive given the size of the park.
It's a really small park compared to a lot of the other areas that have been inventoried. And the number 766 is one of the highest numbers ever found for basically for any park of any size, anywhere in the world.
Of those 766 different species, Spriebele found about 10% are probably new to science. In a journal article that will be published next month, he'll describe five of those new species. One is even a new genus, a rare occurrence.
I like to think of Alaska as being something of the Amazon of lichen diversity.
Lichen prospers in cool temperatures, which could explain why it flourishes in southeast Alaska. Spriebele says the Klondike area is also at an intersection of a lot of different lichen floras, from the Pacific Northwest coast, the Arctic boreal forest, and from the Pacific Rim as far south as New Zealand.
Basically, diversity at this level on 53 square kilometers here in the Klondike Gold Rush National Historic Park is comparable in all other ways to a diversity of other organism groups in the tropics and the Amazon rainforest.
Spriebele says it's especially important to document the lichen species now, as global warming becomes an increasing threat to biodiversity in northern climates. The lichen identifying project was first proposed by a National Park Service employee named Meg Haar, who used to work at Klondike. But she died in a tragic mountain bike accident last summer and never got to see the results of her early efforts. Dave Schirkauer is a biologist at the park.
I think that she would be super, super excited, and one of the new species was also named after her.
That species is called Cocotrema haariae. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
A Seattle-based small ship tour company is trying to pick up passengers left behind when Cruise West shut down operations. American Safari Cruises and its sister line, Inner Seas Discoveries, are discounting next year's Alaska sailings. The lines are also looking into the closed company's assets. Cruise West, also based in Seattle, stopped operations Saturday after its Alaska season ended. The company, with ships carrying about 100 passengers each, also shut down sailings in the Pacific Northwest and other destinations. American Safari's Tim Jaycox says his company, which follows similar routes, is offering $150 to $300 price breaks on next year's Southeast Alaska sailings.
We have informed travel agents around the country and internationally that we do have savings available for those who had already been booked on Cruise West. So if they had been booked with Cruise West and want to go ahead and take advantage of that offer, then they can go ahead and rebook with us.
Inner Sea Discoveries and American Safari ships are smaller and generally more expensive than Cruise West's, though prices vary greatly. It's unclear how many tickets Cruise West will refund, but travel insurance and credit card reimbursements are expected to pay back most passengers. While the company tries to win Cruise West's customers, Jaycox says it's considering the closed company's fleet.
We certainly want to be wise in looking at opportunities. So as time goes forward, certainly we're going to see what's out there and let, you know, all the complications unravel and keep a close eye on everything.
This year, Cruise West sailed four small ships to Juneau, Sitka, Haines, Skagway, Petersburg, Wrangell, and Metlakatla. Inner Sea Discoveries and American Safari plans to sail five small ships and yachts between Juneau, Ketchikan, and Seattle next season. Some will stop at Klawock, Wrangell, Glacier Bay, and Admiralty Island.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com. The Federal Aviation Administration sets rules for the operation of aircraft in airports and provides services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska, and when passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. There's more information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska or toll-free at 1-866-357-4704. This message is sponsored by the FAA.
While moose are what most hunters are bringing out of the field this time of year, biologists in Haines found themselves looking over a distinctive brown bear earlier this week. The animal was killed as he charged a man outside of Haines, but when it was brought into Fish and Game on Monday, its surprising features left biologists wondering how the animal survived so long. Tara Bicknell reports from member station KHNS in Haines.
Jerry Kane from Haines was in the Katsuhin last weekend and was lucky to make it back home in one piece after a bear encounter that put his life in peril. Kane recounted the split decision that might have saved his hide.
Sunday evening, I was over in Katsuhin with some friends that were hunting moose. And with the warm weather, we decided we'd be leaving the next day. So I went off for a walk, being our last night there. And when I was charged at by a brown bear, he came out of the alders across the slough directly at me. I tried yelling and within seconds just turned safety off and fired from my hip or the side of me and just luckily hit the bear in the eye and dropped him.
Kane was using a .338 Winchester Magnum, a cartridge popular with hunting Alaska's big game. The shot went through the left eye of the Bruin, which Kane says wasn't very big, but was noticeably different than any he had seen before.
I've hunted black bear over the last 20 years here and gotten bears 13 and 18 years old in the past and seen worn teeth, but this bear had, you know, pretty much only had one canine and just a bunch of rounded off stubs and just was just really roughed up, a real thin hide and but beautiful big large paws and claws and a big head, but just really rough in the teeth and scars and tumors on the back of them and injuries all over.
Kane properly skinned the bear and turned in the hide with claws and skull, as the state requires. The Department of Fish and Game classified the kill as a defense of life and property. Anthony Krupe is a biologist with the department. In his line of work, he sees bears of various ages and sizes from all over the area.
So it had all the looks of a very old bear. Its front incisors were worn down to almost nothing. Its gums were really calloused over, and its canine teeth were what was the most impressive. It had one solid canine tooth and one nearly almost missing, and then the other two were just sliced down all the way to the root and just barely hanging on, almost as if you were to take a carrot and slice it vertically. And just amazing that this animal has been able to continue to survive with a serious need of a trip to the dentist.
A bear known as Diver in Katmai National Park was believed to have lived at least 35 years, said Krupe, who spent some time researching there. Data reaching back to 1961 shows the Chilkat Valley's oldest bear on record was a 28-year-old male with a 26.5-inch skull harvested in 1990.
I see quite a few big male bears that come off of Admiralty, Baranoff, and Chichikov, and I've taken some impressive photos of these teeth that just you couldn't even imagine a bear is making a living on a dental work like that. So this would be in line with some of these older bears, I would expect, but it's in its late teens, if not 20s, and we will send off a tooth for analysis, and it often takes almost up to a year to get the results back from the medicine lab.
The department generally takes tissue samples to identify genetic markers in the animal. The bear carcass went to the state since Kane didn't have a permit, a rarity for the bear hunter. Again, Jerry Kane.
No, I did not have a permit. We thought about getting one, and I've bought so many in the past. You know, I've had 20 just for these cases. I've bought like probably 20 in the past years and just never really ran into one. And unfortunately, this time, did not have a permit and had to surrender the bear to the state. And after finding out more about the details of the bear, I heard that he could eventually be sold at auction, which I probably try to get the bear maybe later on if possible.
Reporting in Haines, I'm Tara Bicknell.
It will be another year without a commercial fishery for red and blue king crab in Southeast. The fishery was last opened in 2005, but fishery managers say the amount of harvestable red king crab continues to drop around the region. Meanwhile, the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, along with the commercial crab fleet, are trying out other ways of estimating crab stocks in parts of the region. For member station KFSK in Petersburg, Joe Vicknicki reports.
Fish and Game says the amount of harvestable king crab is once again well below the 200,000-pound minimum threshold required to open the fishery. The department says the biomass of mature male crab has been declining since 2001 and is at its lowest level in two decades. Adam Messmer, assistant management biologist for the shellfish program, says of the areas that the department surveys, crab stocks in five of those areas were classified as poor, three were below average, and one was classified as moderate.
That's pretty consistent with past years. Nothing is looking overly exciting at this point.
The last time the fishery was open in 2005, 58 permit holders landed 210,000 pounds of crab worth $1.1 million on the docks. Julianne Curry is director of Petersburg Vessel Owners Association.
Each year that it doesn't open, it's a pretty devastating blow to the fleet. We have a large portion of the Red King crab permit holders right here in Petersburg. So that's all dollars that aren't coming back to the city.
When the fishery has opened, it's been a late-season boost for local industry. Icicle Seafood's Petersburg fleet manager, Randy Lantine, says the markets are strong for what he calls a premium crab.
Our crab especially tend to be larger. We can have crab up to 10 pounds, which is that's a tremendous red king crab. And, you know, there's been more markets developed in the live market area. So, you know, a lot of this red king crab would be sold live, and similar to the golden king crab in February that we harvest, more and more of that is going to live, which is commanding better prices at the market.
Fish and Game comes up with its estimate of the amount of harvestable crab based on annual summertime surveys in nine areas of the central and northern panhandle. It also uses past year's survey information and commercial catch data from the years the fishery has opened. Crabbers have challenged the method the department uses for its annual summertime survey, and that's led to a change in the way the department deploys its survey crab pots. In general, crabbers say there are more red king crab in the water than the department estimates. However, fleet members have been heartened by a new survey project underway. It's a joint effort involving Fish and Game and permit holders catching and tagging crab and then re-catching the crab a second time. The department's Mesmer says the study should provide information on crab stock estimates and crab movement.
Yeah, it'll definitely give us a better idea of how our survey is doing, you know, comparatively. We kind of added on a little bit to that survey where we what we were tagging them with was zip ties, and we bought a bunch of numbered zip ties, and we're going to be recording those where we put them, so we're going to get a little bit of migration data, too, so we'll be able to see how far these things are moving.
The effort started out as a pilot study last year and looked at two other possible methods for estimating crab stocks based on catches in Lynn Canal's St. James Bay north of Juneau. A state appropriation this year, along with a grant from the North Pacific Research Board, has allowed crabbers and the department to expand that study to other areas usually surveyed. A permit holder and department employees are catching and marking crab in 2 to 3 locations this year, with more planned for next year. The information will be used to test Fish and Game's crab stock estimations. iSchool's Lantine says one complaint about the department's survey is about its timing missing the traditional times when crab are on the bite or easier to catch.
Fish and Game does their survey in the summertime, so, you know, guys feel that that may not be representative of what is out there, what they're catching in the summertime. And a more traditional time would be in December and maybe in November. But, you know, with this survey we have now, starting in October, we're going to take a whack and see what we can catch and then mark. And then we'll come back to the area again. And the way this is laying out, it'll be close to November, and maybe we'll see some increased numbers.
Lantine says the collaboration between industry and state fishery managers is a great step. And the PVOA's Curry says for the most part, the association's members are excited about the collaborative effort on studying survey methods.
So they've been trying to work really hard with the department to try and work on surveys and sampling design, and we're looking forward to finding out what information comes from that. So hopefully we can get the Red King Crab fishery back open.
The Red King Crab fishery has only opened 4 out of the last 10 years. In Petersburg, I'm Joe Vicknicki.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Casey Kelly and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Dan Brass in Fairbanks, Tara Bicknell in Haines, and Joe Vicknicki in Petersburg. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., Dave Donaldson from Juneau, and Annie Fite from Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. ACHEA, the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association, has been asked to administer the new temporary federal insurance program that allows individuals with a qualifying pre-existing condition and who have been uninsured for at least 6 months an opportunity to purchase health insurance. Capacity is limited, so contact an insurance broker or ACHEA immediately. More information at achia.com. This message sponsored by ACHEA Fed. Providing statewide news coverage since 1978, we are the Alaska Public Radio Network. APRN, your source for Alaska's news.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.